comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
Ah, the gentle melody of the fun-loving fans of the Super Bowl-bound Raiders, recorded last Sunday at the Oakland Coliseum. Favored Oakland will face the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in tomorrow's extravaganza. Until the mid-90s, the Bucs, a perfect 0-14 in their first season, were essentially hopeless, arguably the least accomplished team in the National Football League, until the Cincinnati Bengals matured into a monopoly of that designation. In 1997, the Bucs made the playoffs for the first time in 15 years. Since then, Tampa Bay has been a postseason regular, and tomorrow, the Bucs will play in that team's first Super Bowl. How many current Tampa Bay fans rooted for the Bucs through those bad old days? One, at least. He's Dick Greco, currently the mayor of Tampa, who joins me now on the line. Mr. Mayor, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, nice to be with you guys. Nice to be in a position to be with you guys.
I'll bet it is. Now, I understand that you played a big part in getting Tampa Bay an NFL franchise back in the mid-70s. This must feel like a reward that's been a long time coming.
Well, it's been kind of strange when you stop and think about it. I was mayor back when we got the NFL team to agree to come here and then left for 21 years, came back, and we were faced with a situation of if we didn't build a new stadium and do some things, the NFL team would leave, and we got all that done. So I was at the front end of it and now at the tail end, and now of all things, playing in the Super Bowl, our city, which is very rewarding to many of us and very much to me, yes, to be honest with you.
And I understand that in that in-between time, you managed to pick up a Super Bowl ring of your own.
Yeah, I was, the 21 years in between, I was with DeBartolo Corporation. And, of course, as you know, in San Francisco, Eddie won 5 Super Bowls. I'm wearing one today just to show people what they look like.
What do you do if you guys win again on Sunday? You have one for each hand?
Well, I would like to have one, yeah. It would be great. I'd love to win on Sunday.
In the NFC Championship game between the Bucs and the Philadelphia Eagles, you had made before the game the traditional bet between mayors, and I understand that you won assorted cheesecakes and Scrapple. Did you know at that point what Scrapple was?
I'll be honest with you. They handed me the list of what the mayor is going to send, and when I went out to make the phone call like we just did with Jerry Brown, I looked at the list and realized, what in the hell is Scrapple? You know, I didn't know.
Uh-oh.
But I didn't want to ask and appear ignorant about it. So I came back in my office and I asked one of the girls, what is that, by the way? And they looked it up on the internet and they said, you think we better come here and read this? And it says Scrapple was a meat product made up of mostly things off of a hog's head, such as tendons, eyelids, gums. And the next sentence said, and other unmentionable parts of a hog. And I thought, my God. But now that I talk to people from up there, everybody eats it, and they say it's great.
So did you end up eating any of the Scrapple, or do you have a dog you can feed it to?
He hasn't sent it yet, but I'm sure it's on its way. I'll try it. Yeah, why not?
Well, you better tell me, what are the stakes for the Super Bowl game?
Well, we just talked to Mayor Brown, and he talked about going up and staying with him. He said I could stay in his flat, and he was going to cook for me and show me around the town. He said if I want to, I could go to a spa or something. He told me earlier on the phone, and he's going to send a few things that they make up there in Oakland to eat, mm-hmm. and we're going to let him come down here and stay at the Marriott Waterside, go to several of our great restaurants, Burns Steakhouse, Columbia, one of the companies here, we're famous for cigars. The Numa Cigar Company is going to send him a humidor of cigars.
Excellent.
And we're going to send him Tampa cookbooks, guava jelly sangria, Cuban bread, Cuban coffee. He's going to have a behind-the-scenes tour of Busch Gardens. And you know what? Win, lose, or draw, if he wants to come down here, we'll do most of these regardless.
And I understand that win or lose, Tampa is planning a celebration for the team. What's that? What's planned? What's that going to be
Absolutely.
Like?
Absolutely. Actually, they're coming back Monday evening, and win or lose, people are going to greet them at Tampa Stadium, and I expect a huge crowd. The other night when we won the championship game, it was like 1 something in the morning when they got back, and there were 30,000 people out there to meet them.
Out at the airport?
At the stadium. That's okay. Where they leave their cars.
Uh-huh.
And Tampa's that kind of town. We turn out for those types of things. It's getting to be a big city with a smaller city atmosphere. We're like one great big family. And I'll tell you, they're turned on about this. All you see is colors and Buccaneer colors and flags on cars, and it's a real mania.
Now, people know something about Raiders fans. They've long been characterized as the most rowdy, the most inebriated, the most likely to paint themselves up into weird costumes, put horns on their heads and more heads on their shoulders and look like monsters. Can you compare a Raider fan to a Tampa Bay fan?
Not at all, really. I mean, here, they're great fans. They're loyal. They've stuck with this team for 27 years. They turn out in the middle of the night, but it's very subdued. Florida's kind of like that when you stop and think about it. We come down here to have fun, bask in the sunshine when we're not working, fish, boat, do all kinds of wonderful things. People are very relaxed here.
You spoke about the reception that the team got coming back from the conference championship game. Have you been to visit the Buccaneers yourself?
Absolutely. I saw them off. I boarded the buses and wished them luck before they left. Along with many people, they had a huge crowd when they left for the game and an even bigger crowd when it came back. Actually, I've got to tell you that I had planned a hunting trip to Mexico last weekend with five other friends of mine. We flew to Hallerton, Texas, which is on the border, watched the ball game there, got so excited. All of us, we went crazy. My cell phone started ringing. What are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? I went on into Mexico. My wife called, who had been to Philadelphia. All my friends were calling, said, you can't be gone. So someone sent a plane, and I flew back the next day. Did not get an opportunity to hunt, and I'm glad I did it because this place has been crazy since I've gotten back.
So you don't resent the fact that the Buccaneers have ruined your hunting trip?
No, absolutely. I can always hunt. You can't always play in a Super Bowl.
Dick Greco is the mayor of Tampa and one of the many Buccaneer faithful who will be in San Diego this Sunday. Mr. Mayor, thank you once again.
Thank you, friends, and maybe we'll see you there.
Last weekend, a double disappointment was dealt to the Philadelphia Eagles and their fans. Philly lost the NFC Championship game by a score of 27-10 to Tampa Bay and spoiled what was supposed to be a fond farewell to Veterans Stadium. And as the team gets set to move into brand-new Lincoln Financial Field next season, some fans say it will never be quite the same again without the Vet. Dave Naylor reports.
E-F-E-L-E-S-E-O!
Last weekend, in the shadow of Veterans Stadium, Eagle fans began their tailgate parties in the early hours of the morning. It was cold, unpleasant, and nasty. Perfect conditions for one last farewell to the Vet. Visiting teams and fans are glad to say goodbye to what some consider an ugly and smelly old concrete bowl. But to legions of blue-collar Eagle fans, this is a very special place.
Yeah, maybe our stadium's a sh-hole. Can I say sh-hole? And you know what? It's our sh-hole. We love it. The facility is not killing our spirit. It's killing everyone else's spirit.
Rawness at the Vet. It's all raw. Anything has to do with the Vet, you have to be a true Eagles fan to be at the Vet.
Oh, man.
I wish they'd just renovate it and keep going with it, because it's a great place for football.
Not only do Eagle fans cheer vociferously for their team, they are notorious for making players and fans of other teams feel unwelcome. Last week, fans hung dolls of Tampa Bay head coach John Gruden in effigy all around the parking lot. Others poured lighter fluid on a Tampa jersey and burned it to cinders, which is all part of why the Philly Police Department had a huge force in place last week, on horseback, foot, and on motorcycle. Philly fans have always let it be known that no one at the Vet is welcome to cheer for anyone but the Eagles.
They're crazy if they do that. It's our stadium, it's our fans, and, we don't appreciate that. We really don't.
This is the only city you can come to where we don't allow other people's fans to come in here. They can't sit in any other seats without being harassed. This is our stadium, and we don't want nobody else coming in here, fans or teams.
Nobody wants to come to the Vet, so that's what the best part about it is.
Across the street, Lincoln Financial Field is rising up out of the ground. Next fall, it will be the new home to the Eagles, and fans are worried it will never be quite the same. Most Eagle fans can't imagine that anything in the new park can ever match the rowdiness of the Vets' infamous 700 level, the uppermost tier of seats notorious for the rowdiest behavior.
I think the 700 level emulates the people of Philadelphia. It's a blue-collar city, a tough city, and that's the tough section up there. Some people are scared to go up there, but I don't really know why. Look, if you don't see a good game, you do have fun up there in the 700s.
It's all about the rich people, the new stadium, you know? They'll pull up in their BMWs, come a half hour before the game, but we'll still be here at 8 o'clock in the morning.
It'll be sad.
Of course, most disappointing to fans is that the Eagles weren't able to give the Vet a proper send-off, earning a berth in tomorrow's Super Bowl. Eagle fans were so deflated by the end of last week's NFC Championship game that there was virtually no rowdiness when the final gun sounded. No, the final moments of football at the Vet were much more somber than most of the three decades during which the Eagles called this place home. For Only a Game, I'm Dave Naylor in Philadelphia.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. On Sunday night, in an episode violent even by the standards of professional hockey, Edmonton Oilers coach Craig McTavish ripped out a dog's tongue. The dog, the 6'6", 200-pound, cute-as-a-big-button mascot of the Calgary Flames, named Harvey, had allegedly been taunting the players on the Edmonton bench when Coach McTavish grabbed the foot-long tongue hanging from Harvey's fuzzy mug, yanked it out, and threw it to a fan. A Flames spokesman acknowledged that, quote, Harvey was in a place he shouldn't have been. At the time of the incident, the Flames, Harvey's team, had been leading 4-0, but after the tongue-ectomy, Edmonton scored 3 unanswered goals.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Serena Williams etched her name in tennis history today, beating big sister Venus and winning the Australian Open. It's her fourth major tennis championship, a Grand Slam sweep. To read more, log on to our website, wbur.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. And by Pensler, direct language programs, featuring over 35 different languages, including American English for speakers of foreign languages, now available at the Public Radio Store at wbur.org. It is 16 degrees in Boston. WBUR supporters include Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for 15 years with multi-platform protection on servers, desktops, and mobile devices, SOPHOS.com. And TechFusion, restructuring IT departments with new technology to help meet clients' reduced budgets. Information at TechFusion.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game Super Bowl Haiku IX. But first, Franco Harris, late of the Pittsburgh Steelers, knew when he caught a deflected pass and ran it in for a touchdown to beat the Raiders in the closing seconds of the AFC Conference Championship game in 1972 that he'd made a remarkable play. He did not know, could not have known, that by doing so he'd become almost unimaginably important to a lonely little boy who was watching the game on TV. Stephen Dubner's Confessions of a Hero Worshipper, a candid tale, tells the story of that boy and the man he became and of his hero as well. Stephen Dubner joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Stephen, welcome to Only a Game.
Good morning, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You were 9 years old when you saw the play that came to be known as the Immaculate Reception on a snowy black and white TV set. You write of that moment, I was overcome with a sort of joy I hadn't known to exist. Even for fans who weren't 9 years old and ripe for hero worship, Franco Harris was an admirable fellow.
Heck yeah.
Couldn't have picked a more attractive hero, at least in terms of his symbolic potential.
He was, yeah. I mean, symbolic potential is exactly right. The intellect of a 9-year-old is not particularly sophisticated, but there were different elements of his person that appealed to me so much. He was very good. He had a great rookie year, and he helped the Steelers win their division for the first time in their 40-year history. So there was the lovable loser aspect of it. In terms of his personality, he was really good, but he was also very humble. He wasn't a chest thumper. He'd score a touchdown, and he'd just kind of toss the ball to the referee. Even when he scored this fantastically dramatic, immaculate reception touchdown, he just kind of became engulfed by all of Pittsburgh, his teammates, the fans jumping out of the stands, and he didn't even, you know, raise his arms and pump his fists. He wasn't so demure. He was very confident, but he wasn't a lunkhead the way that a lot of these guys were, and even more of them are now. Plus which, though, he was from a strange and mixed-up background, as was I. He had an African-American father who was a soldier during the Second World War and met this gal in Italy and married her, and Franco was the offspring of that marriage. They had 9 children. His mom was a devout Catholic. And I was one of 8 children from a devout Catholic family, and my own parents were kind of mixed up as well, in that my mom and dad were a pair of Brooklyn-born Jews who, before they met each other, had both converted to Roman Catholicism and then proceeded to really reinvent themselves. And so I grew up with a kind of strange, mixed-up, murky background, and Franco had a racially mixed-up background, and plus which... Then a year later, my own father died when I was 10, and that's when Franco turned into almost, in my mind, I never met him when I was a kid, but turned him almost into this sort of messiah figure, which sounds crazy and loopy and overstated, but that really was the case.
So he was not only a hero for you to worship, not only a father substitute, but something really much more grand even than that.
Yeah, I mean, there are 3 very fierce attachments that most of us have that are very, very similar. Hero worship, religious faith, and romantic love. Psychologists have a term for this called the urge to merge, which is that each of us feel within ourselves a great need to attach ourselves to someone or something greater than or larger than ourselves, to either to inspire us or to save us or to support us. And Franco really embodied all those things for me. So I signed my papers Franco Dubner in school for a few years and tried to persuade my mom to let me legally change my name. She offered me Francis as a confirmation name after St. Francis of Assisi, which was a very poor substitute. Plus, I would have had to wait till confirmation.
A recurrent theme in your book is a dream that you had involving Franco Harris. And I gather the dream was always the same, and at least through years of your childhood, it came to you almost every night.
It was. It was. I would go to the VFW hall in Albany where Franco was coming to speak, and I would ask him to come back to my house where I had asked my mom to make spaghetti and meatballs. My mom was a wonderful woman, terrible cook, but her spaghetti and meatballs was all right. And it was because he was half Italian that I asked her to make that. And we would eat, and then I would persuade him to come out in the yard and play ball with me. And it was one of those games you have as a kid where, you know, it's just 2 of you, but you imagine yourself as the whole team. And we were the Steelers, and we were playing another team. I think it was the Oakland Raiders, although it was hard to tell. And it was a very toe-to-toe battle, and it would get down. We were trailing by a point. Time was running out. Franco takes the ball, runs, and gets tackled, and he twists his ankle. And he goes down very hard, and he gets up, and it's the time for one more play in the game. And I'm fully expecting him to carry the ball for the touchdown and let us win. But instead, he gives me the ball, and he says, "Kid, you're going to have to take it from here yourself." And the dream would end right there every night. And every night, all I wanted was like 10 more seconds of dream to see, you know, do I make it? Does his ankle recover? And, you know, as a kid, it's funny. I always thought this was a quintessential kind of rescue dream where he was coming to this fatherless boy, me, and rescuing me. But it wasn't until the writing of the book when I had a lot of thinking and dreaming about and then interaction with Franco, because I've spent the last couple years sort of tracking him down or what he might consider stalking. And it wasn't until now that I realized that it wasn't a rescue dream at all. He didn't really do anything for me other than tell me I needed to do it for myself. And, you know, I went to him in Pittsburgh recently, late in life, thinking he would still somehow fulfill this gap I had from childhood without a father. And in the end, he couldn't do that. And in the end, it was up to me to do that.
As you mentioned, a huge portion of the book involves your attempt as an adult to connect with Franco. At one point, you even fantasize that you'll become best friends, your wives will become best friends, you'll move to Pittsburgh, your children will play together. It becomes quite extraordinary in your adult mind.
It all made sense for a brief time there. I can't explain it now, but it really did. It didn't work out quite that way. We got off to a great start. I wrote him a letter. I was in my 30s by now, fully grown, theoretically. I was working, writing for the New York Times magazine.
I love theoretically there.
Yeah. You would think I would, you know. But when I saw his picture on a cover of this magazine, it was Black Enterprise magazine, a business magazine, I hadn't thought of him in years. And I just was flooded with memories of the feeling that he had provoked in me when I was a kid and this great feeling of admiration and allegiance I'd had. He did invite me to Pittsburgh and picked me up at the airport and he gave me a tour of the city. We had lunch, we had dinner, all this great, what I considered very intimate, personal conversation. But that ended up being kind of the highlight. The next couple of years, I was spent kind of being stood up by him and rebuffed by him and scrounging for crumbs and ultimately becoming disillusioned and even turning on him a bit before I made some sort of peace with it.
It strikes me, though, that there's an interesting aspect to your relationship now, because the problem with being an athlete is no matter how great you are, when you get into your late 30s, early 40s at the absolute latest, if you're a football, basketball player, baseball player, it's over and you have to find something else to do. Whereas if you're a writer, you can be just hitting your stride in your late 30s, early 40s. You can write the best book you ever wrote when you're 55, you know.
From your mouth to God's ear. Yeah. You know, it was one of the things that I really most enjoyed writing about and most wanted to write about with him was the afterlife of the athlete, which is fascinating. I mean, you know, because once you're off the field and out of the spotlight, a lot of people just don't care at all, except in Pittsburgh, where Franco is. You know, those Steelers won 4 Super Bowls with Franco. They haven't won one since. Every year that the Steelers don't win a Super Bowl, Franco and his teammates from back then, Terry Bradshaw, Lynn Swann, Jack Lambert, Joe Green, I mean, there were a lot of great ones. They get bigger and bigger. Mm. This play, The Immaculate Reception, thanks to ESPN and ESPN2 and ESPN Classic and Fox Sport, you know, that play is like, you know, it's the Zapruder film of Pittsburgh and of football. Everybody knows every frame. And so Franco, even though I would have thought he would have welcomed some attention and an opportunity to be written about, frankly, I think he feels he doesn't need it at all. I think he feels his image is just fine, thank you, because it's like being a movie star and you made these great movies when you were so handsome, 27 years old, 25 years old, all your skin, your cheeks, everything was just right, and you just live on like that.
Stephen Dubner is the author of Confessions of a Hero Worshipper from William Morrow. Stephen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks.
The Super Bowl is the most relentlessly hyped event on our crowded sports calendar. It is a football game, certainly, but beyond that, it's a significant cultural event or a gargantuan embarrassment, depending on your point of view, a test of strength and courage or a hideous festival of excess, or both. But whatever else tomorrow's game is, great and bloated, overrated and polluted, perhaps even exciting, it is, as far as only a game is concerned, an inspiration for haiku. For 9 years now, we've explored the delights and mysteries of Super Sunday via the format of the 3-line, 17-syllable poem. Hence, Super Bowl Haiku, IX.
Ahoy, San Diego! Prepare to be plundered! Yarg!
Where's my ticket?
Fans of each team pray for a win. Sponsors
for a fourth quarter, we'll watch.
Tagliabue Dreams parody. Then, Unbidden Nightmare. Super Tie.
The Little Flutie, on bus platform, watches, yearns. Bound for Saskatoon.
NFL worry. So many close Super Bowls. Time for a stinker?
Eagle sails blue sky, Titans big smile, haiku, but Buccaneers? Raiders?
Arr, Jim Hawkins, arr. Buccaneers and Raiders, Jim. Our Super Bowl, yarr.
Armies gather poised. Bookend Echo says, we're all Buccaneers. Raiders.
Al Davis, baby. His super outlaw Raiders. Pete Rozelle's bones spin.
Yarg! Go Buccaneers! Yo ho ho!
Just past the Cheese Whiz already. The Brown family, Bengals owners, won. Just one. But ha, the money.
It's mind games, he said, tapping broken knee, cracked head. You outsmart 'em, see?
Football wobbles like no other ball. Like jello. Like someone concussed.
All the blood, rage, spit, tape that make a football game. Make a poem, too.
Tipped pass wobbles, hangs, money riding, taped paws whack air, bright painted ground.
Tampa's pirate ship marooned on the wrong coast. Arr! Where's the damn U-Haul?
The bookie, calm now, quiet always, shifts the bets. No player, a pro.
Yarg! I've not seen a long snapper with a wooden leg before. Yarr!
They are not pirates.
Yar!
No, they're football players.
Yar! They play for gold.
We're all patriots, said Mr. Kraft last winter.
So, what are we now?
Silly coach, screaming. The call stands. You change nothing. But your hat explodes.
That last haiku is, of course, the gem of the collection as far as we here at Only a Game are concerned. It's read each year by the inimitable James Isaacs, a.k.a. George Carter, who is joined in this next rendition by a translator to the delight of our Spanish-speaking listeners. Yo espero.
Silly coach, screaming.
Coche tonto. Grita Rio.
The call stands. You change nothing.
Los soportes de la llamada. Usted no cambia nada.
But your hat explodes.
Pero su corazón, kaboom!
And now a rendition that might, we think, delight even the bard.
Silly coach. Screaming. The call stands. You change nothing. But your heart explodes.
And a veritable surprise symphony of Silly Coach.
Silly Coach, screaming. The call stands, you change nothing. But your hat explodes!
And one more time to carry us through the long, long year until it's Super Bowl time once again.
Silly Coach, screaming. The call stands, you change nothing. But your hat explodes!
a cannibal. On a pirate ship, we'll need 44. Just to last the trip, so load those cannibals. That's a powder rip, watch them fly. Watch them fly.
And our cannonballs on a pirate ship and the scurvy. Let us not forget when there is scurvy. On your pirate ship, eat alive.
Eat alive.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org.
On a pirate ship, when you dance a jig, it's easier to slip when there are pay legs. On a pirate ship, so dance a jig.
Dance a jig.
Dance a jig.
Dance a jig.
Dance a peg leg. On a pirate ship, along with cannonballs. Let the powder rip, don't let the scurvy. Roll the trip, eat alive.
Eat alive.
Eat alive.
Eat alive. What else we got on a pirate ship, Captain?
Bunny rabbits! Hey, there are bunnies.
Bunny rabbits?
Well, I thought we had some.
That is rum. On a pirate ship, if you drink too much, the ship will tip, drinking rum. On a pirate ship, you better share.
You better share.
You better share.
There is rum. On a pirate ship, along with peggy legs and cabin, both enough to last a trip, but there is scurvy. On a pirate ship, so eat alive.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a grocery store where buyers travel the world for international fare like Mexican quesadillas, Indian simmer sauces, imported Italian risottos, and Asian dumplings, TraderJoe's.com. By Feynman Remodeling of Arlington, striving to create satisfied clients through innovations in architectural design, craft, and management. Feynman Remodeling, 781-643-6269. And Boston University Career Programs, offering complimentary half-day classes in security, wireless networking, or project management certification. Registration at 1-800-BU-TRAIN. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, Paul Pierce had 45 points as the Celtics beat the Nuggets 77-58 at the Fleet Center last night. The Bruins hope to stay on the winning track at the Fleet Center tonight when they host Philadelphia. The final tallies are in from NBA All-Star voting among Eastern Conference forwards. Antoine Walker finished fourth. Paul Pierce was the fifth leading vote-getter among guards. Both Walker and Pierce are likely to be named as reserves on the Eastern squad. This spring, join NPR Scott Simon and Robert Siegel on our next Citizens of the World tour, exploring the natural wonders of Africa. To learn more, call 800-909-9287. Partly sunny, cold today, highs in the upper 20s. It's 16 degrees right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up Monday on Point, the UN Weapons Inspectors report, President Bush says time is running out for Saddam. Temperatures are high in the Security Council, and the world wonders, will Washington make this trigger to war? Up-to-the-minute coverage of world reaction to the Iraq weapons report. That's on Point Monday night at 7 on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the latest candidate for the distinction of ultimate sports road trip. But first, a look at the week's sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I think there's no point in beginning anywhere other than with the words you're known to utter on the day before the grand and glorious annual Festival of Excess.
The Super Bowl is good.
Nicely done. And do you pick the Raiders to triumph over the Buccaneers in this first ever super battle between pirates?
I do, in fact, not. I picked the formerly creamsicle-garbed Tampa Bay Buccaneers to win this game because I'm not exactly sure at what point in the last 10 days the Oakland Raiders became a juggernaut.
They are the favored team, though, the Raiders.
Yes, they are, and they are favored by people who I think are overestimating their abilities, particularly on offense, because I think Tampa Bay's Derek Brooks is going to do to the Oakland wide receivers pretty much what the Patriots did to the St. Louis Rams wide receivers last year. And I think they will tangle them up in a game where their offensive firepower is less of an advantage than it was last week. And I think, I mean, I hate to sound like an NFL guy, but defense does win these things. And I think Tampa Bay's defense is better than Oakland's offense.
All over listener land, I can hear people picking up their phones and dialing their bookmakers and taking the points.
We have nobody who in our listenership that knows any bookmakers. You know that?
Evidence that 800 basketball wins isn't such a big deal after all, Charlie. This week, another coach reached that mark.
Yeah, they're coming by the bucketful. Jody Conrad, who's been coaching at Texas for 34 years, got her 800th win this week when the Longhorns beat Texas Tech. Bob Knight on the men's side, oddly enough, at Texas Tech is only two or three away. Mm-hmm. You know, this is rather like baseball pitchers getting 300 wins. The reason we don't see it very often is that very few baseball pitchers who start the game finish the game anymore. And there are very few people who coach college basketball, either on the men's or the women's side, who stay in one place as long as Pat Summitt and Jody Conrad have.
A news report featuring various sources who don't want to be featured or even identified has it that Pete Rose is ready to admit that he bet on baseball and will throw himself on the mercy of Bud Selig. What if some of the relatives of Shoeless Joe Jackson and the rest of the Black Sox come forward and say, hey, our guys admitted it too. Let them in.
Well, they're all old and they're not moving real fast these days, so Bud can probably dodge them. You know, once again, the preposterous situation of Pete Rose gets even stranger by the day. If he's willing to put on the right dumb show for everybody and he's going to have a probationary period, although why baseball should care now whether or not he gambles is beyond me. You know, he will be allowed to be admitted into the Hall of Fame where he should have been all along. The people who think Pete Rose is the Antichrist are not going to be mollified by any apology he gives. The people who think he should be in the Hall of Fame, as I do, simply because it's a museum for old things and dead people, and he hit the baseball safely more often than anyone else, don't really care. But there's this vast middle ground of people who sort of like really don't give much of a damn one way or the other. And this will give baseball, you know, a chance to look compassionate and warm and forgiving. And I think that's basically what Bud is swinging for.
And meanwhile, I gather the Internal Revenue Service is watching carefully as events unfold.
You can apologize as abjectly as you want. The Internal Revenue Service doesn't care. Yeah, they put a lien on Pete's condominium. He apparently owes them still some back taxes. I don't know what effect this will have on his quote-unquote probation once he puts on the right dumb show for Major League Baseball to be allowed back on the Hall of Fame ballot. I just know that there is no Veterans Committee with the IRS. If they want to get you, they'll get you no matter how old you are.
Charlie, every revelation about the U.S. Olympic Committee suggests that it cannot get any more weird, but this week it did again, right? There seems to be no honor among thieves or among bureaucrats.
Well, I mean, as we say always when we address this, it is a good thing that our governor here in Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, managed to clean up the USOC and the whole Olympic movement before he left Utah to become our governor. Otherwise, maybe USOC leaders would be calling for President Marty Mankmeyer to step down and charging her with a conspiracy to force the previous CEO out of his job.
On Tuesday, members of the USOC will meet with Congress to answer questions about
possible ethical
violations, so we don't have to worry about a thing. Senator McCain, one of your favorites, will preside over that meeting. Can Congress straighten out this current mess?
Well, the problem is Congress, most specifically Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, wrote the legislation in 1978 that gave the USOC control over America's Olympic program, and how's that working out for you? But what they're going to do about, you know, backstairs backstabbing of, you know, the USOC president and the USOC CEO is beyond me. I mean, they have handed it over to a group of people who, like their IOC colleagues, simply cannot be trusted to organize themselves and conduct themselves in an ethical manner.
On Tuesday, the WNBA will reportedly announce that a team based at the Mohegan Sun Arena will begin playing this summer, meaning that its home court will be associated with a very large and profitable casino. Does the term appearance of impropriety apply here?
Apparently not. Apparently, the Mohegan Sun is a very safe, warehouse full of gamblers in which a professional sports team can prosper. It looks like the Orlando Miracle, oddly enough, Nikisha Sales, the player for the University of Connecticut, who was granted the layup to beat the school record, which
That's
caused
right.
a lot of stamping and huffing and blowing from people who don't like women's basketball very much in the first place, plays for the Orlando Miracle and will be returning to her home state.
On Monday, the NBA acknowledged that officials in last Friday night's game had goofed. They called a flagrant foul on Shaquille O'Neal when he hadn't committed one, apparently. Shaq rather ungraciously complained that, quote, a whole bunch of people paid a lot of money to see a game decided by someone who doesn't make a lot of money. He's not lobbying for the refs to be paid more, is he?
I think not, no. I saw that quote myself, and I said, gee, not a nice thing for Shaquille to do. And then I realized that's not what he's saying at all. He's calling them a bunch of nickel and dime incompetents. The important thing, of course, is that flagrant fouls in the NBA total up and eventually add up under a system of assessing points for flagrant fouls, can end up with a suspension. So knocking this one off Shaq's record can have some repercussions down the line.
It's also interesting to me that in the matter of really just a few weeks, both the National Football League and the NBA have turned around and apologized and said, yeah, you're right, our guys got it wrong.
Well, it's only a matter of time, of course, before we start hearing the NBA referees saying they're being hung out to dry by their league, and how dare they actually point out that we're responsible for our own incompetence.
Finally, Charlie, I give you a competition in which nobody in attendance loses. The contest to determine the world's best curry is underway in Great Britain. How'd you like to be an official in that one?
Hey, listen, I know so much about food that the best curry I can think of is either Eddie Curry, who plays for the Chicago Bulls, or the college you teach at.
There you go. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and spits fire for Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
From time to time at Only a Game, we hear from folks, almost always guys, who want to discuss with us their summer trip to all the Major League Baseball parks. To that achievement, Andrew Kulik and Peter Farrell would no doubt say, big deal. Kulik and Farrell, who call themselves the ultimate sports road trippers, have not only seen games in every big league baseball, NFL football, NHL hockey, and NBA basketball stadium or arena, they have ranked each venue according to its various charms, or lack of same, on their website, thesportsroadtrip.com. Andrew Kulik and Peter Farrell join me now, each from his home in Buffalo, New York. Gentlemen, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having us. We're glad to be with you.
Pleasure being on your show.
Andrew, was it you or Peter who decided to devote all this time to visiting the homes of each team in all of the four major U.S. sports?
We kind of came up with the idea together. And how this all started was in early 1999. We were sitting around a sports bar one night enjoying some food and some beer, and it kind of just came up. What if we were to do all 30 hockey arenas? And it seemed like a daunting task, but the beer kept flowing and we kept talking. And by the time the night ended, we had this grand plan, and we looked at it and said, oh my God, Calgary, Sacramento, Salt Lake City, how the heck are we ever going to pull this one off? But that's when the ultimate sports road trip was hatched, and we started traveling and knocking off the venues.
Peter, did either of you go into this trip with preconceived notions about any of these venues that you were going to visit? And if so, did they change? Where were you surprised?
I think the first place that we were really surprised was Fenway Park in Boston. I mean, we've heard about all its charm and how it's a wonderful place to see a game, and to a point it is, but yet for a 90-year-old building, we were really surprised about how run down the place was and how out of shape it seemed to be becoming. That's probably the first place I think of when it comes to places that were just disappointments and things that just changed my mind about a venue.
Well, I was struck by the fact that you didn't like Fenway Park, and you gave the place that replaced Tiger Stadium in Detroit 5 stars. Where is your sense of nostalgia? You're a guy who says Field of Dreams is your favorite movie.
Well, I think when we went to Comerica Park in Detroit, we were really blown away by how they celebrate their history. I mean, that's really big for us. If you go through the main concourse of that building, you'll see all kinds of giant-sized bats, one representing each decade, and all just loaded with memorabilia, you know, celebrating the Tigers' cherished history.
Mm-hmm.
I have not yet seen a place that really decked out their past the way they did it there.
New Jersey does not fare well in your ratings. You don't like the place where the Devils play hockey or the place where the Nets play basketball. In fact, you rate the latter as, quote, one of the nastiest places in sports. Is this just the usual U.S. anti-New Jersey bias, or is there something more going on here?
The building isn't crumbling and falling apart, but our experience with the New Jersey Nets was just absolutely disgusting and brutal. And that's why we rated that as one star and tell people don't go there. We're still waiting for the apology, quite frankly.
You mean the Nets management treated you badly?
Well, yeah. Well, the game day staff. And when we rate these venues, we have the very strong feeling that people spend a lot of money on game tickets. And we're both single guys and, you know, have modest incomes that we can support this kind of thing financially. But there are people out there where attending a game and taking wife and family, that's a big expense. And they deserve to be treated with respect. Our problem with the Nets is this. We went into the building and attempted to take a photo of us. We'd like to have a picture of us to prove for posterity that we were in each building.
Mm-hmm.
It meant walking to the midcourt. There's only one concourse. Going down to about the 20th row in the bowl and asking somebody to snap a photo. When we got there an hour before game time, the usher wouldn't let us pass. We don't have a ticket in this section. And we showed our book. We said, look, we just want to snap a photo. She would not let us take a photo. We went then to guest services and pleaded for some help. And they were just absolutely, they should be called guest indifference. They were like, you know, sorry, we can't help you. They said, write a letter if you don't like it. Well, the story didn't end there. I mean, after the game, we said, okay, the game will end. We'll go down there. Well, these ushers, rather than games over, they all go home. They were standing like freaking sentries at each alcove. Tickets, please. Finally found a distracted usher who was dealing with something else and blew by him. We got somebody to snap our photo. And as that's happening, we see that first usher pointing and waving her arms at us and all upset. And we're like saying, hurry up, take the photo. Then a few seconds later, out of our corner, we're seeing a security guard running, talking in his walkie-talkie. And we got the picture and we went rushing out of there. And it's like, by the time we got out of the building, we were out of breath. That's our story there.
Got it. Andrew, it does seem to me that one of the things that appeals to you guys is gimmicks. You like the XL Energy Center where the Minnesota Wild play hockey, in part because the organ there is shaped like a Zamboni. You're pleased by this sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, the new modern touches that give buildings character, and that's one of the cool things about that building. The whole building is designed like a ski lodge. There are jerseys of all the teams in the state, of the high school teams, hanging in the along the rafters and the concourse. And then they have a superior digital technology where there are two levels of digital surround LED boards. I mean, the great special effects that they have there. Mm. So it's a nicely done building. I mean, everybody can put an average oval in there and make it put in nice tile and lighting, and it could be very nice. But it's those little touches that give the hometown character to these buildings.
One of the buildings that was not rated very highly was Qualcomm Stadium in San Diego, host to the Super Bowl. It's good enough for football's biggest game. Why'd you guys rate it so low?
It's basically an older building. Admittedly, the weather's nice and it's wonderful, and that's what's going to bring a Super Bowl out there more than anything. I can't imagine them ever bringing a Super Bowl to Ralph Wilson Stadium back in our backyard. It's nice on a great sunny day, and gosh darn it, the fish tacos are great. But, eventually a shovel for a new building will come, and that's just the way it's going to be.
Now, you guys have traveled around to all these places to see games. I wonder how often you've been disappointed not only by a building or the way you've been treated by people, but, you know, a 12-1 baseball game or a 46-3 football game is a letdown no matter where you see it. Has that happened to you very often, or have you lucked out into good games more often than not?
I think one game that will always stand out, and please remember that we're from Buffalo here, and is that we were in Nashville, Tennessee about 3 years ago to the day here when Frank Wycheck threw his infamous questionably lateral pass to Kevin Dyson as he raced down the sideline in what is now known as...
It was a forward lateral.
Yes, the forward lateral, yeah. The Music City Miracle, I don't know what you want to call it, but we saw it, and that game is number one on our list of memorable games.
Peter, you guys have rated all the places you've seen along various lines. You've rated the food at a lot of these places, but I think it's only fair to point out that you mentioned in your little thumbnail biography that your favorite food is Hostess Orange Cupcakes, so we're not operating from the perspective of a gourmet exactly here, are we?
Oh, gosh, absolutely not. The more sugar, the better sometimes, you know. I could give you one place, one particular food off the top of my head just really blows us away, and that's every time we go to Pittsburgh, there's a stand called Primanti Brothers. It's really just nothing more than a sausage sandwich, but they do have french fries and coleslaw that are not on the side of the sandwich as part of a side order, but actually in the sandwich.
Mm.
And you can imagine how far your cholesterol meter goes off the level after a couple of those during a game.
That's what you're after, is that you're telling me?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the more grease, the better, you know. If it takes care of us early, then so be it. I die happy, you know.
All right. When you hear that a team is going to build a new arena or a new stadium, do you feel a surge of excitement because it means you've got to get back out on the road again, or is this getting a little tiresome?
Oh, gosh, never tiresome. It was a surge of dread when we heard the Charlotte Hornets were moving to New Orleans because it's like, damn it, we have to go back. There are shovels in the ground right now for 9 new venues in the 4 major sports. 6 will open in 2003 and 3 more in 2004. And as they open, we will be returning to check them out, critique them, and, of course, rate them on the website.
Andrew Kulik and Peter Farrell have witnessed games in every Major League Baseball, NBA, NFL, and NHL venue, and happily for only a game they've lived to tell the tales, their website is thesportsroadtrip.com. Fellas, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate the opportunity to share our story on your show.
Around the world, I've searched for you. I traveled on when hope was gone to keep a rendezvous. Well, I knew somewhere, sometime, somehow, you look at me and I would see that smile you're smiling now. Well, it might have been in County Down, in New York, in Gate Paris, or even London Town. No more will I go all around the world, for I have found my world in you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Ben Trefney and from NPR in New York and from the Only a Game haiku players. Christine Fischera, Walter Dixon, Anna Benstead, Keith Shields, Kelvin Brooks, Ted O'Brien, George Hicks, and our special haiku reader in residence, James Isaacs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 post-paid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Stephen Dubner's Confessions of a Hero Worshipper, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Haiku Rookie of the Year, Christine Fischera, who can't quite pin down a vital NFL pronunciation.
So this first word is Tallybaloo?
Try that just one more time.
Tagliabue.
And Only a Game player never makes the same mistake twice. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
In New York, in Gate Paris, off swinging London Town, no more will I go all around. My world in you. Yes, I found my world in you. I like it, I like it, I like it, I like it.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. We